Business of the day, Folk v. Warden, number 25-2014. And I think we start with you, Mr. Solos.
Yes, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name is Jack Solos, and I, alongside my co-counsel, Madison Rinder, represent the appellant, Omar Folk. I will address the exhaustion question, and Ms. Rinder will address the statutory interpretation merits question. When Mr. Folk handed his appeal to prison staff, he satisfied his obligation under BOP regulations to submit an appeal within 20 days. He therefore properly exhausted administrative remedies. The court should reverse the decision of the lower court holding otherwise for two reasons. First, the prison mailbox rule applies to the regulations at issue in this case, and second, Mr. Folk's habeas petition raised a pure question of statutory interpretation for which exhaustion was not required.
Mr. Solos, did your client even preserve the mailbox rule argument? We see it with a citation to Houston, but that's toward the back of the petition under a different provision. How is that enough to preserve the issue?
Aside from the citation that you mentioned on JA-21, at JA-116, in his objections responding to the government's response to the habeas petition, he also states that he did all he could to appeal. Furthermore, on JA-22, he kept a record of his attempts to contact prison staff to verify that he did, in fact, submit his appeal by handing it to prison staff on April 20th. And furthermore, we think most convincingly, the magistrate judge also understood Mr. Folk to be raising this argument. At JA-7, the second paragraph of JA-7 is the magistrate judge's opinion, and that is the dominant feature of the page, and it's a fulsome discussion of the reasons why the magistrate judge believed the prison mailbox rule did not apply to this case. We believe that legal conclusion was an error, and we've briefed that before this court, but we're simply taking up a holding of the magistrate judge. The magistrate judge discharged his obligation per Dooley versus Wetzel to liberally construe the pleadings of pro se prisoners by addressing the prison mailbox rule argument. And we've merely taken that argument up on appeal from there.
You would agree that if we look to the program statement, then the mailbox rule clearly would not apply.
We dispute that, Your Honor, because the prison mailbox rule provides a rule of decision if the regulation is ambiguous. If the regulation, per Longinet versus Cruising, does not clearly require actual receipt, and Longinet directs the court to focus on the specific language of the statute or regulation, if that does not clearly require actual receipt, then the prison mailbox rule applies.
But the prison mailbox rule is a judicial doctrine, and when we're trying to resolve ambiguity, we look first to the text, and wouldn't an interpretation by an agency of its own regulation be primary in doing that analysis of the text before we would resort to a judicial doctrine like the mailbox rule?
In this case, Your Honor, we believe that any deference to the program statement at issue is not appropriate because we explained this in our brief, but we believe that under Kaiser versus Wilkie, our deference isn't appropriate here because at the first step, BOP's interpretation of submit is requiring actual receipt isn't reasonable because it's at odds with Longinet versus Cruising, with Houston versus Lack, with published case law of this court and the Supreme Court. And so therefore a contrary interpretation would be unreasonable. And furthermore, moving on to later steps in the prison mailbox in the Kaiser analysis, it's not within BOP's statutory mandate to administer. Their statutory bailiwick is correctional policies, and deadlines involving filing dates and submission dates are not necessarily within their purview. And so at the later stages of the Kaiser versus Wilkie analysis, it's not appropriate to afford the program statement the same level of deference that would ordinarily be owed. And again, we'd like to reemphasize that as then Judge Kavanaugh said in National Mining Association when he was on the DC Circuit, guidance, which the government does not dispute that this program statement is not binding on the parties, and it's merely, it doesn't go through notice and comment rulemaking. It merely states the government's position on what the regulations mean. But the regulations at issue here do not clearly define the word submit, and the government has not produced any dictionary definitions of submit, nor any other evidence that it clearly requires actual receipt. And so because it clearly does not clearly require actual receipt, the prison mailbox rule applies. And because it applies, Mr. Folk discharged his obligation to submit his appeal and handed it to prison staff.
You say it's clear under Houston that submit would encompass the delivery to the prison staff. But the purpose of Houston was essentially a leveling of the playing field, right? It was providing the opportunity for those who were incarcerated and not able to control delivery in the way that someone who was not incarcerated could do. Here, when we're talking about prison grievances, that is not the case. Everyone's on the same playing field, as it were. So why would Houston require that submit here be interpreted to mean the delivery to prison staff?
Yes, Your Honor. In fact, this decision would level the playing field because currently the Bureau of Prisons is bound by a different vision, which the government cites, 542.18, and that states that an appeal is considered filed when it is received. And it's from that deadline that BOP's obligations to respond to the prisoner then run. Their deadlines run from that provision, and their deadlines don't begin until they have the document in their possession, which makes sense when they can actually begin to respond to it. And so, but it makes sense for the purposes of the prisoner's submission deadline, that that deadline would be when they lose control of the document, per Houston versus Black. And that would be when they hand it to prison staff, as Longenet requires. And so we think that that would actually level the playing field and furthermore serve the purposes of exhaustion. And with the balance of my time, I'd like to quickly address the second grounds for excusing exhaustion, the statutory interpretation question. Mr. Folk's habeas petition at JA 19 through 21 raised a pure question of statutory interpretation for which exhaustion is not required. As Ms. Rinder will take up shortly, the question is essentially whether combined together his ineligible and eligible sentences under the First Step Act render him ineligible or eligible for credits under that act. And that is a decision that this court can make without any need for additional fact-finding or information.
Well, if it were eligibility alone, that would make sense. But at JA 20 in the petition, the relief requested is FSA eligible to earn year-off sentence and RDAP approval with the facts of any FSA credits approval. Doesn't that latter portion of the request get into application in his case?
No, Your Honor, and I see my time has expired. I'd like to reserve some for Ms. Rinder. But no, Your Honor, because the primary ask that he is making, is, as you referenced at J 19 through 21, is this eligibility request. And that's indeed all the court can decide at this stage. And then later, we believe that the First Step Act operates in a two-stage approach. First, the court must decide whether or not a prisoner is serving a sentence for conviction under an eligible or ineligible offense. And then secondly, we do not dispute that there are some discretionary factors, such as a prisoner's enrollment in evidence-based recidivism reduction programs, that would then determine whether how many time credits a prisoner receives. And so it's entirely possible that this court or the lower court could rule him eligible, and then he could receive a minimal or small amount of time credits based on the discretionary factors that are totally within BOP's control.
Well, you're out of time. I don't want to myself take up the whole playing field, so let me ask my colleague if they have any questions at this point.
No, thanks.
Judge Roth?
No, thank you.
Okay. And Mr. Salas, I may have missed it, but were you reserving any time for yourself or your colleague?
Yes, Your Honor. 8 minutes for me, 7 minutes for Ms. Rinder, 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court. A prisoner with multiple sentences should be able to earn time credits for their eligible offenses. And there are four points that I would like to briefly make before returning to them and elaborating on each of them. The first is that interpreting 3632 to allow prisoners to earn time credits for their eligible offenses is faithful to the plain meaning of the statutory text. The second point is that this interpretation best comports with the statutory scheme and purposes of the First Step Act. The third is it does not require that this court break with binding precedent or disregard persuasive reasoning from other court cases. And finally, 3584C does require aggregation, but it requires aggregation for administrative purposes, and earned time credit eligibility determinations under 3632 are not administrative. So returning to my first point then, this broad reading hews closely to and does not depart from the plain meaning of the statutory text.
Well, let me reverse the order there, because the statutory text includes, of course, 3543, and that for this is where it's an administrative interest does require aggregation. Why where other time credit calculations are considered administrative purposes, why isn't this one?
So 3584C requires aggregation before administrative purposes, and we would distinguish the eligibility determinations at issue here as substantive eligibility determinations subject to policy considerations versus based on administrative considerations, which are at issue with the other credit determinations. So in 3632, Congress lays out a mandatory eligibility scheme that turns on policy considerations. Are these prisoners part of a class of prisoners that are less likely to recidivate upon release from prison? In contrast, we have other credit determinations, those in 3585, 3624, 3621, and all of those turn on more administrative considerations. 3585 turns on mathematical or logistical ones. When did the prisoner show up to begin their sentence? Mathematically, how long is their sentence? How long did they serve in prison prior to their sentence?
But with all of those, Congress is making some decision to make these eligibility for some reduction with those credits. And there may be different policy considerations, but that just shows what's behind the passage of that particular section. In all of them, including this one, it would seem that when it comes to administering the sentence and making the calculations for what the reduction is, or in this case, even making the determination about whether someone has completed the recidivism reduction program would be administrative. Why isn't that the case?
So responding in two ways. First of all, I would distinguish Congress passing the statutes laying out each of these credit programs from, again, eligibility turning on policy considerations. There's no administrative Congress, in passing all of those statutes that I mentioned, had a policy objective in mind. However, when we look at the eligibility determination 3632, it's not turning on administrative considerations. It seems to just be hinging on those policy considerations. And then also, I just want to clarify, the way the 3632 earned time credits work is that there's this threshold eligibility determination, again, laid out in the statute, turning on policy considerations. Later, BOP does get involved in administering the earned time credits. You know, it must apply the statutory interpretation to the particular inmate. It must assess the inmate's risk of recidivism. It must reassess the risk of recidivism. It must then determine the number of credits that each prisoner is eligible for. So it's not to say that there isn't BOP administration involved, but that's not what the eligibility determination is turning on in the way that, for example, 3621 credits turns on an administrative consideration like resource constraints. But you don't see that same kind of language with 3632. 3624 turns on an administrative consideration like Has the prison complied with institutional regulations, something more bureaucratic? Again, that's not what we see in 3632 itself. And so, again, just to clarify, all of these statutes were passed pursuant to a broader policy objective, but that's distinct from the eligibility determination, which in 3632 turns on policy considerations, not administrative ones, and that's distinct from these other types of credit determinations, which do turn on administrative considerations.
Let's go back to 3632 then. Yes. What's your textual argument there?
Absolutely. So the language is very specific. It says a prisoner is eligible if they are serving a sentence for a conviction. So that language focuses us not just on the prisoner, but it has a limiting modifying language that focuses us on the sentence. At this moment, if you look at JA 105 to JA 107, particularly focused at JA 107, that lays out Mr. Folk's specific sentence comprised of constituent sentences. And based on that, we understand that at this present moment, Mr. Folk is serving a sentence for his 841A1 offense, and that offense is not listed as one of the 68 offenses that is ineligible per the statute. And so, again, per the statutory language at this very moment, he is serving a sentence that makes him eligible for earned time credits.
Well, it doesn't say the prisoner is ineligible when he is serving a sentence for one of the enumerated convictions, right? So if he is serving a sentence, and I think you recognize that he has one sentence, right? There's one judgment of conviction and sentence that lays out his aggregate sentence. So why wouldn't Congress used the term while if they wanted to break it down the way you propose?
I think they could have. Again, I think we're focused on the serving a sentence, which connotes a present sense, you know, that he is currently at this moment serving, the timing wise that he is. And yes, he does have a later sentence for 924C, a 924C offense, but necessarily by the judge's sentence, he cannot be serving that at the same time as his 841A1 sentence, because it must be 924C offenses must be served consecutively.
I think having this be this particular 924C example being your case, that makes it actually a little more difficult to, because 924C sentences will always be consecutive to any other sentence. And so Congress apparently thought that 924C was a disqualifying offense for some purposes, but it would always be separated and served consecutive, whereas I think most of the other offenses on this list could be concurrent sentences. And so why would Congress have wanted to say, okay, we're going to give you, you know, you have this extra, we're going to punish you with a more severe term of imprisonment, making this consecutive, nonetheless allow you to get earned time credit for your other convictions?
So I guess to respond in three different ways to your question, the first is, I think because this is a 924C offense and it has to be served consecutively per the plain language 632, this is the easy case. And so I would just like to clarify that, I guess, as an initial point. Secondly, I think if Congress, again, just thinking about the plain language, if Congress had wanted to disqualify someone who, like Mr. Folk, has committed a 924C offense, is not presently serving that, but that is of the multiple sentences. Oh, I apologize, my time is up, and I would like to remain reserve some for, okay, perfect.
You're on our time.
Wonderful, thank you. I think that Congress could have used different language. They could have said a prisoner is ineligible if they have been convicted of. And so again, I think we have to look back to the statutory language itself. And then as a final point, the non-aggregation approach takes due consideration and account of the 924C offense. Mr. Folk and inmates like him will never be able to earn time credits for that sentence. That sentence will be served separately. He will never be able to earn time credits. That sentence will never be able to be reduced subject to the earned time credit program. The non-aggregation approach just prevents inmates like Mr. Folk from having additional penalties imposed on them. And there's two ways of thinking about those penalties. One is BOP is basically treating him as serving a 264-month sentence for something that he only received 60 months for per the judge in the underlying criminal case. Or a different way of conceiving it is he's right now serving a sentence for an eligible offense and otherwise would be able to earn time credits, but he is being he's not allowed to earn time credits for that eligible offense because he has this other offense. It's basically tainting the eligible sentence. And so, again, the non-aggregate approach treats his 924 sentence appropriately per the concerns, and he will never be able to earn time credits or anything for that. It's just about preventing him from being penalized otherwise when he is not serving that sentence.
Droth? Any questions?
I have no questions.
Okay, we'll hear from you in rebuttal.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. Matthew McHale on behalf of the appellee warden here. So 2 points. First, the volume of prisoner grievances and litigation can be overwhelming. BOP has developed a comprehensive administrative remedy program that Mr. Folk is well familiar with based on the number of grievances he files. Requiring administrative exhaustion serves a critical purpose, not just to weed out meritless grievances, but also to make sure that scarce resources are preserved so that the ones with merit can be addressed. In this case, Mr. Folk failed to submit his appeal in a timely fashion, and there's no basis to create a prison mailbox rule here, that an argument that was not preserved below, I would suggest. And lastly, on that first point, excusing his failure because of an issue of statutory interpretation is also unwarranted. And second, on the merits, Mr. Folk is not eligible for earned time credits under the First Step Act because of his 924C conviction and because the statutory language makes clear that his sentence for that conviction needs to be aggregated for administrative purposes.
Well, the mailbox rule is the default, right? Unless you can point us to something that shows that what was intended clearly is receipt. So what is the clear evidence in the text of the statute or surrounding provisions that shows its receipt and not the default?
I push back a little bit. I don't know that I would call the prison mailbox rule a default necessarily. It is a judicially created doctrine that may, courts may decide to apply in some circumstances. But I would say the main principle in which that determines when it should not apply is where there is a comprehensive scheme and language that already makes clear when a document needs to be filed. And in this case, when you look at the BOP regulations and read them all together, not only 542.15, which talks about, which requires a prisoner to submit an appeal to the appropriate regional director within 20 calendar days, or then on the next step, submit to the general counsel within 30 calendar days. And that doesn't say submit to prison staff for forwarding to the regional director. And when you read that with 542.18, which tells us and tells the prisoner that an appeal is, quote, considered filed on the date it is logged into the Sentry system, quote, as received.
So I struggle a bit with both of those, because in Houston, didn't the Supreme Court reject the notion that having the name of the recipient, there, the clerk of court, as part of the regulation, answered the question. It concluded that it was a question of timing, not destination, and did not ascribe relevance to the clerk of court being the one there that received it.
Well, Your Honor, I guess I would say that here it's not only saying that you need to submit it to a specific person, but then it also in 542.18 tells the prisoner when the document is considered filed, and that is on the date of receipt. And that focus on the date of receipt is reflected in all the administrative records of how these administrative grievances are tracked.
Why doesn't that show the opposite? Because 542.15 initially used the term filed as well, right? And it's in 1986 updates that language was changed from filed to submitted. So why doesn't the meaningful variation canon tell us that submit in 18 means something different?
I still think you have to read them all together. And just because, and the text of 0.15 and 0.18 make clear that the submitting to a specific person and then the date of receipt by that person or entity constitutes filing. And in addition to that, I would note there is specific allowance made for what happens if appeals are late. And Mr. Folk was directly instructed that if, because his initial appeal to the regional director was too late, he could submit or, you know, file a staff memo or some kind of explanation as to why that occurred.
So the staff memo system doesn't seem to not work well in this situation. I think the response Mr. Folk got was, we're not going to accept the proof that you gave us because you don't have a staff member attesting to the content of your mail to the regional director, right? So, I mean, so is the suggestion that he would have to show his grievance to one of his immediate custodians in order to prove that he in fact mailed that grievance?
I don't know. I mean, he could have done more than what he did, Your Honor. And I would say that, I mean, this court in the Tiffin case, for example, which was a non-presidential decision, is an example of a prisoner who, upon being told that his appeal was too late, he can come back and give reason for a valid delay. Mr. did not do that here. All he did was eventually submit an email exchange that showed that there was some legal mail that went out on April 20th. But there's no way to
know the destination that was the appropriate destination for appealing.
You know, Your Honor, I'm not sure it's that specific.
I mean, it says Northeast Regional Office.
Okay, right. Fair enough. So, thank you. Sorry. But because Mr. Folk, you know, he filed on April 14th, the same day that he filed this grievance for the First Step Act, he also filed three other grievances. And those, at least one of those, he also appealed to the regional office. So, you know, the record as it is does not indicate whether, you know, whether that mail, what mail went out on April 20th, whether it was this grievance for the First Step Act or whether it was another grievance of the many that he'd been filing. So, you know, in this case, he blew the deadline. I would suggest, and again, just going back to something I said at the start, I don't think that he preserved the argument that the prison mailbox rule should apply here. But even if in this case, I mean, sometimes deadlines are going to have, you know, consequences. They may result in an appeal being too late. But I would say that this case is a bad example of taking a sort of unpreserved argument for application of the rule here when he could have argued that there was some reason for a delay, and he could also have filed a new grievance. I mean, I don't know that there's any reason why BOP would take a position that he is now somehow barred from raising this argument, which he contends is an issue of pure statutory interpretation, which I take some issue with. But instead, we sort of have gone down this path of, I mean, he's filed like FOIA actions to try to get, you know, look into when his mail went out. And so I think that the simpler approach here would have been for him to just either comply with what he was told and file and explain his delay, or file an grievance.
So let's say it's not exhausted. Why doesn't the exception for pure statutory construction apply?
Well, Your Honor, I read, and the district court also read his request to be asking for, it's a little unclear, but he seems to be asking for, he talks about wanting 1 year off of his time. Now, it may be that that actually pertains to his request for RDAP credits, which he sort of talks about on the same page, but it's not clear that this is an issue of pure statutory interpretation. And again, I would say that even if this court is willing to entertain that argument, which again I don't think that argument was preserved either, I don't think he can show that he was prejudiced by the procedural default here, because again, I don't know what would prevent him from just filing a grievance, and so, you know, arguing that he is, you know, making this merits claim about being eligible for the time credits. And so, again, I think the value of having and of reliably applying procedural default rule is to reliably enforce it in such a way that it doesn't encourage prisoners to try to characterize their requests as pure statutory interpretation. It doesn't reward prisoners who don't comply with the, you know, pretty straightforward rules of administrative exhaustion. And so I think those are reasons why here the court should not indulge that argument on that point. I would also just, the last thing I would say on the exhaustion thing is that also, I was sort of struggling to think about how that prisoner mailbox rule, for example, would be applied sort of administratively. And I think there are serious reasons, policy administrability reasons why it would not be a good idea to, I think, be the first court of appeals that would decide to apply that rule here. From what I can, I believe the Northeast Regional Office here, which is the BOP's office for handling appeals, they cover for all the states in the First Circuit, all the states in the Second Circuit, I mean, all the prison facilities in those circuits, Third Circuit, but not Delaware, and then Ohio, which is in the Sixth Circuit. So it would be difficult, I think, to have a rule that apply that this court, would hold that then, would apply within the Third Circuit, but then the regional office would have to be dealing with prison facilities that are not in the Third Circuit. I think there would be very serious practical consequences as well that just count and counsel against that.
Let's say we get past all of that. Let's hear your thoughts on the merits, and let me focus you on the outset on the text here. As Ms. Reinder pointed out, as Judge Wynn argues in his dissent in Bonney versus Dunbar, that the term serving suggests that you're looking at the particular sentence associated with that conviction. And you can't serve a 60-month sentence in 264 months. So why don't we start there, never even looking to surrounding provisions in determining the eligibility for earned time credit?
Well, Your Honor, we can start with Section 3632. I would say, so I would note that to start with Section 3632, it is in Chapter 229, which is literally called post-sentence administration, number one. So I think that is perhaps a small clue as to how that section, these programs should be considered. On the language of 3632, I mean, as Judge Freeman was saying, it could be written, I think that if Congress intended for these kinds of sentences to be sliced and diced in this manner, especially a 924C sentence, which is always consecutive, and I think something like 90% of 924C convictions are in fact, there are other convictions as well. I think you'd expect to see a word like when or while or during or something like that, and that's not there. So that's to start with. But number two, it has to be read in the context of Section 3584C, which has been on the books for 30 years before the First Step Act was passed. And so, you can't read 3632 in isolation. I mean, I think it's just that simple. And when you look at 3584C, which says multiple terms of imprisonment, ordered to run consecutively or concurrently, shall be treated for administrative purposes as a single aggregate term of imprisonment. You put that together with 3632, which is in Chapter 229, which is called post-sentence administration. And when it does involve, as I think my friend on the other side was, I don't know, conceding, but was discussing the sort of other aspects of this program that involve, prisoners' role in it. There's a determination made as to whether prisoners successfully complete programming. Mr. Folk, my understanding is that he and other prisoners like him who do have disqualifying convictions for the earned time credits, they can still, first of all, they can still participate in, anti-recidivist reduction programming. And I think that does entitle them to some benefits as well, such as email privileges, phone privileges. There are other categories of incentives that are provided to prisoners like him. But when it comes to the administration of a program like this, which involves, again, making these programs available, determining whether they've been successfully completed, and then also, yes, whether a prisoner is in fact eligible or not for them, I think the best and really correct conclusion that I recognize Judge Wynn's dissent, but like all courts of appeals who have considered this have all rejected the argument, similar argument made. And so I would suggest that this court should not be the first to create a circuit split on that issue.
How do we reconcile that with the goals of the First Step Act, which include to provide a motivation to participate in these recidivism reduction programs?
Your Honor is right that was a goal, a major goal of the First Step Act. At the same time, the statutory text represents a judgment by Congress that some prisoners, some defendants who have committed certain crimes are not suitable for that incentive. And you know, if you look at the list of criminal convictions, I mean, there are at least 50. I think there's something like 74 different convictions, and they involve 924C, of course. They cover some 841 drug trafficking convictions if the person is subject to an organizer leader enhancement. So I think if you just consider the text of all those offenses, it's a fair assessment that Congress is here, making a judgment that these offenses are particularly serious and should not result in reduced time. Now these defendants, these prisoners, can still get good conduct time. That does still operate. So there are still some basis for reducing their prison sentence, but not this one, I would suggest.
Given that goal of the First Step Act, why is that not appropriate to take into account in interpreting the term serve when looking at what makes a prisoner ineligible?
I mean, I don't think that you, I guess given the statutory text in 3584, I don't think that the sort of general policy goal of the First Step Act is enough to overcome that. If Congress had wanted to, maybe it's an application of the principle, Congress doesn't hide elephants in souls or something like that. But I think that if Congress had wanted to set the well-established text and application in 3584, I think that there would be a much clearer statement in 3632, other than just taking out a word like serving, whether it's a word that doesn't exist, like when or during. But I think a reasonable reader would expect to see a much clearer statement from Congress than is there. So I just don't think that's enough to overcome the statutory text. I would just, lastly on that point, I would just say that also Mr. Folk argues that the rule of lenity should entitle him to credits here. We don't think this is a penal statute, and even if it were, there's not a grievous ambiguity here that would be enough to overcome that.
Judge Roth, let me give you the opportunity for questions. No.
So in conclusion, we'd ask the court affirm. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Rinder, one of the points you did not get to was ways that the outcome you're requesting is consistent with our precedent, and you pointed to precedent of other circuits. But as your friend on the other side of the aisle has pointed out, the other circuits that have addressed this question have come out the other way. So what is the authority outside of the circuit that you're pointing us to? And aren't we, if we go with your lead, we're creating a circuit split, right?
So there are no Court of Appeals opinions that we are pointing to outside of this circuit or within the circuit that support our case. So on some level, it would create a circuit split. But I think two points to that point. I think that on the basis of the plain language of 3632 alone, you can find that Mr. Folk is eligible for earned time credits. And to the extent that many of these other cases rely on 3584C, yes, the outcome would produce a circuit split, but there might be a fine distinction there in terms of the reasoning as not creating a direct circuit split. And then we also find the other court cases unpersuasive, and therefore they're not binding and they're not persuasive for this court. For example, Giovinco is a case that is cited in the briefings, and it is unpersuasive for some of the following reasons, and this also rebuts some of the points of the government. The first is that there's this idea in Giovinco that if Congress wanted to require non-aggregation, it could have done so more explicitly. But by those same terms, Congress could have, if it wanted aggregation, could have required that explicitly, and it did not do so. Secondly, Giovinco relied again on the distinction that I referenced earlier of the threshold eligibility determination that must necessarily precede subsequent BOP administration of earned time credits. When you look at the language of Giovinco and some of these other cases, they talk about how earned time credits are administrative because of the computation of credits or the computation of a sentence, for example. But that is a later issue. The eligibility is the threshold issue, and again, that turns on policy determinations. And again, Giovinco, to our discussion earlier, Giovinco references these other types of credits and how the court reasoned by analogy to find that 3632 credit determinations are administrative. But again, those other credit determinations have been appropriately found to be administrative. These are distinct, and we cannot reason by analogy. So these are just a couple of points distinguishing some of the other court cases too. They rely on Chevron, which is no longer relevant here. Some of the other cases rely on a workability idea that it's difficult to non-aggregate. But if you look at JA 107, the judge in the underlying criminal case very clearly laid out his sentence at different points. And it's very easy to go in and say at any point eligible or ineligible. So for just some of these reasons, those other court cases are unpersuasive and certainly not being. And just to briefly mention the two Third Circuit cases, in addition to not being binding, also rely on 3584C, and I believe Teed again speaks about computation or calculation of the credits or term of imprisonment. And so again, in that way, there's a little bit of, I just want to emphasize the distinction between the threshold eligibility determination and the subsequent BOP administration. And then just to respond to a couple of points, I just very briefly wanted to note, Judge Freeman had noted something about this is your proof, and just wanted to direct you to JA-22 of the joint appendix as the reference point for that. To respond to the staff memo, I just want to emphasize that exhaustion is an affirmative defense, so the government has the burden to definitively prove that Mr. Folk did not submit a staff memo or a valid reason for delay, and it's not clear from the record that he did not do so. Another quick point, turning to them, is just, I think we would just again emphasize, I don't think while serving versus is serving is a significant distinction. I think still is serving connotes a present sense. At this moment, he is serving a sentence for a conviction. And in addition, apologies, another point I wanted to just respond to was that back to our earlier discussion about how 924C offenses are necessarily, they have to be served consecutively, raising the question of what if it is a concurrent sentence. I don't think it's necessary with the concurrent sentences that, I think it's also possible to understand non-aggregation as applying with concurrent sentences as well. We just want to emphasize that with the consecutive sentences, with the 924C offenses that have to be served consecutively, it's just an easier case because it's so clear. And then, I apologize, my time is up. I had just wanted to end with just re-emphasizing the broad purposes of the statute, as Your Honor had mentioned earlier. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. Thank both counsel for excellent argument this morning, and we will take this case under advisement.